we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
Hello everybody, welcome to episode 98 of the Integritrust podcast. Two more to go till we get to the big 100.
Woo-hoo!
And yeah.
We're celebrating early.
I know, yeah. So we've got Mark Farley. Hey!
We're going to party like it's 99.
No, that's for next week.
Never mind.
We have Elia Dean.
Hello, America. Yeah, I just got back from a couple of fillings at the dentist, so one side of my face is in excruciating pain, so forgive me. I can talk clearly, though. But I still made it on the podcast, but now I've got two new fillings and a microphone. I'm ready to go.
So does that mean you've got beer coming out of one side of your uncontrolled mouth?
Oh, man, I wish. That sounds like a really good idea. Let me mute myself and go get a beer.
And get a bib.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's funny? I mean, we're going to talk about this on the podcast anyway. But can you imagine having that kind of work done to your teeth like 100 years ago?
Oh, my God.
And here we are complaining, you know? It's like, that would be, well, I think you'd rather die in some cases. Never mind.
You'd probably get really drunk, right? I mean, they drank whiskey.
Oh, yeah, you'd have to.
Yeah, that probably is.
And you probably wouldn't have those teeth anymore.
No, they just rip them out.
They're that's
like,
true.
Forget it. Useless. Pull it out. Yeah, my dentist, though, he's an artist. He's like the Michelangelo of dentistry. I must say, but painful.
Yeah, we'd all be putting pieces of wood in our mouths to chew up the meat.
Yeah, so actually, when I was last at the dentist, she told me that she'd had a patient in the past that had asked not to have an anesthetic because they had like, they didn't react well to anesthetics, local anesthetics afterwards. So she was like, okay, you do understand. He's like, yeah, no problem. So she began the surgery, and a couple of minutes into it, I had to give him a local because he suddenly decided he wasn't as brave as he thought.
Yeah,
that was not the best idea.
It was a very bad idea. I had probably like, 10, 11 shots or something, throughout the process because of the extent of the fillings. So, yeah, good time.
You sound like as much of a wuss as I am, man. It's just like, I can't get enough of that Novocaine. I had knee surgery last week, and they gave me Novocaine for my knee. And that was interesting. I think the general anesthetic they gave me was something like you get when you get a colonoscopy. Not that you guys would understand anything about that. So you're not knocked out all the way. So coming back from the general's not bad. But man, when the Novocaine wore out, it was like, I thought it was going to be great. I thought, this arthroscopic surgery, no pain. It's like, oh yeah, there was pain.
It doesn't affect how well you can drink a beer though.
No, not like in your mouth. It does impact your swizzling capabilities.
Hey, Mark, do they have to give you extra medication because you're like, not Mr. Tylenol, you're Mr. Naproxen, aren't you? It's like, oh, Mr. Farley, yeah, we can hear those Naproxen jingling around in your pocket there. I think we're going to have to double up the dose for you, sir.
Yeah, well, they did give me the pre-surgery stuff to read, which, I barely read, but it did include the fact that they didn't want you to take painkillers a couple days before.
Oh, nice.
Did you adhere to that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not the pill form.
Right. Well, they didn't specify the liquid.
Yeah. And I probably should get a green card or get a card for it out here, to get the smoke form, but I haven't done that.
Can you get that? In California, can you get, let's call them recreational drugs on prescription for pain relief?
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, medical though, right? Like Denver, like Colorado, you can just go to the store and buy it.
Sure.
But
yeah.
California, you actually have to get like a doctor, right, Mark?
You can get a doctor, but the doctors are easy to find.
Right.
There's always these guys getting drummed out of the business and they'll do anything. It's apparently not hard to get. I've been told I'm idiotic to not have one and that I should just get it over with, but I haven't. So there you go.
You should get it now before all the GPs or like the general practitioner doctors are replaced by Watsons and AIs and stuff like that, because I think they will be less easy to convince.
Oh, that's probably true. Yeah, I got to do it before Watson starts shutting us down.
Yeah. You know, on that note, shall we pivot to the agenda and then start talking about some of the interesting stuff then?
Mm. I don't think we introduced Lauren, though. Lauren's on the show.
No, Lauren, you need a round of applause, I think so.
Yay!
One. Yeah.
That's all right.
Yadine saves the day.
Thanks, Yadine, for looking out.
Oh, yeah. I got your back. Us beer drinkers have to stick together. I'm so ashamed.
That's right.
Never mind. So what have we got? We've got robots and autonomous cars saving lives like here, there and everywhere this week. We've got more airline technology woes. We've got phones and Internet of Things device security exposures all over the show. And in biz-related news, we've got acquisitions, we've got lawsuits, we've got company name changes. And, oh, we've got something on being banned from presenting at VMworld. And it's such a shame that Rick's not on the show, because I know Veeam got banned from presenting at VMworld maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, and I wanted his inside scoop on that, but no can do there. So on the line of robots and autonomous cars and things saving people's lives, right? And because we've been talking about medical stuff, right, let's hit the Watson one first. So we've had Watson successfully diagnosing a lady with a rare form of cancer. I believe this was in Japan after her doctors failed to correctly diagnose the cancer. So they, I think, and you guys can correct me or clarify on this, mistakenly diagnosed her for one form of leukemia, given her a bunch of drugs, didn't work. And then when everything failed, so to speak, they called on Watson. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. They did kind of misdiagnose it. I mean, they were close, obviously, but once they started treating her for what Watson said she had, it started working, and she, you know, I don't know what the actual prognosis was or diagnosis or if she, you know, is getting better or not, but it did help. The problem with Watson, of course, being that Watson can only use the data that we have, so a lot of rare diseases that we don't have a lot of data on, well, Watson won't have any idea of how to diagnose that, right? Of course, that'll continually be better, I imagine, as we collect more data, but I think we're still left to the humans in the medical field at least to gather that data.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that's missing is that intuitive component of the natural AI. So, I mean, it took, what, 20 million oncological studies in order to feed it into Watson, and along with her genetic information for it to make the diagnosis, which I think is fantastic. And I think, and not to, you know, swing the pendulum too far in one direction with the argument, because some people will say, well, this is an AI, or that's not AI. And, you know, Google's AlphaGo is an AI. But it is all of these components together, in the same way that our own minds work, that actually will create, I think, the first AI. And if the first AI would really be just a hack of a whole bunch of different things together, you know, will it be deep learning? It'll be a whole bunch of data sets that are analyzed. But the problem is that, to your point, Lauren,
is that you won't have that intuitive component yet, or we don't see that intuitive component yet that can sort of intuit new ideas without large data sets. And I think that's where, you know, the humans, of course, are gonna add value, at least for, you know, for the next century. Hopefully, we'll still be useful to the machines, who will be our overlords by that time.
Oh man, this should be our hot or not hot, because I can't disagree with you more, Yadine.
Oh, really?
I think the diagnosis of cancer is all going to be data driven within 10 years. The immunology that goes into it and the compilation of genetic data, and here's why. You know, a patient in Japan has this situation. Watson may or may not have had access to information that was in other repositories, right? So what's happening is the medical community is building this global repository of information about different kinds of cancers, and then how that relates to an individual's DNA and all of that makeup, right? I mean, this is the direction. They look at your DNA, they look at, you know, how you are composed and how cancer attacks you, and they come up with treatments based on that. I think this is a great case of where the more information you can get centrally from all human beings related to cancer, you'll start seeing these kinds of AI diagnostics made. And in the future, I think it's going to be all machine-based diagnostics.
I think, Mark, if you look at it from this perspective, and if you're entering into a differential diagnosis conversation with a group of doctors, and you look at all the different symptoms, and you look at the reactions to certain treatments, and you have a large data set, then absolutely, you're going to have a vastly more accurate diagnosis system within an AI framework than you would with a human being or a large collection of human beings even. The thing is, you run into issues when you don't have those large data sets and you run into a differential diagnosis situation where an AI cannot give you an accurate diagnosis simply because it doesn't have the data sets in order to be able to drive that diagnosis. So I agree with you on one point, but I don't agree with you that all diagnoses in the future are going to be data driven. I think there's going to be the really cutting edge ones are going to be human driven.
Well, then we have the issue of privacy, though, right? So, Mark, I mean, you mentioned, you know, having all this information about genetic information and medical history and whatnot. Do we have the security, you know, currently, or are people actually implementing the security to keep all of this data private? So I think that's another aspect of it, just purely technology driven, right?
Yep. Yeah, medical information, privacy, the abstraction of that data to be made available in large pools, those are all hard things. I mean, you know, the medical industry is struggling with just trying to keep records, period. So, yeah, we've got a ways to go, but it's my belief that cancer diagnostics, I don't know the name of all that stuff better, but is certainly going in the direction of computerized or intelligent aided diagnostics.
I think I certainly agree with that. I side, I think, more with Mark. I mean, Yadin, I don't know if I'm picking on words here, but you seem to suggest that you didn't think going forward these diagnostics would all be done by computers. Can I just ask you, are you talking about the 10-year time frame there? Because surely you must believe that in 50 years, 100 years, they will all be done by, you know, AIs and things like that.
I think they'll be a tool. And I think the vast majority of diagnoses will be made without even interacting with a human being. But I think there's going to be, and just to make sure that I'm specific on that point, that a small percentage of those that need humans to intuit a diagnosis based on certain things that the AI cannot accomplish, that's always going to be done, and that there may be a really long tail to that. So for the majority of that point, yes, I agree that, you know, in the future, you're going to be able to talk to Google and say, hey, Google, I've got these symptoms. It's going to ask you questions, and it's going to, you know, you're going to give it answers, and it's going to come up with a diagnosis that's probably going to be somewhere in the 95th percentile of accuracy.
Didn't we talk a few weeks ago saying, you know, potentially we won't even have to ask Google because Google will be looking at our searches and realize that we're searching on certain things, and I'll say, you know what? The last 150 people that searched on those things ended up being diagnosed with this. Therefore, go and speak to your doctor. So
I'll take it even one step further, Nigel. You'll be at Starbucks and you're like, you know what? I don't want extra whip today. And an AI will automatically spit out saying, oh, you're pregnant. Like, what? I just didn't want whip today. That's all. It's like, nope, I know. Already
at
know.
At the same time as the drones are taking off from the roof.
Exactly.
Of
Starbucks. See? Right.
So there we go. We've got two new lines of business for Starbucks: drone infrastructure and the new first line of defense for diagnosing symptoms and things like that.
That's right.
But I have a serious question here, right? We've said for a long time, or at least there's been kind of a feeling that sysadmins are going to be out of jobs as, you know, developers and tools and things like that just take over the world and we won't need sysadmins anymore. And you know what? If it's happening, it's taken a long time. Are we going to see a point where, I don't know what you guys call them in the States, right? We call them GPs, general practitioners, like your doctor that you go and see first line of, okay.
Same name.
Okay, so surely those guys have got to be crap scared about their jobs going forward, because that's like the perfect thing to go and not even go down to a surgery anymore, but again, talk to it online and say, hey, you know, I've got these symptoms. What do you think it could be? That's going to be taken over by AI, surely.
Yeah, as soon as we get into the Alien or Star Trek things where you go into a big machine, it's like a CAT scan, but it's, you know, the CAT scan 50 years later, and it just sees everything that's inside your body. You know, why even go see a GP? Just get probed and prodded by diagnostics.
Yeah. And I think you'll be able to skip the GP in certain circumstances because you'll already be able to, you know what's what's wrong with you and be able to direct to a specialist, or the GP can automatically refer you without even having to go see them. Or, you know, what is happening more and more now where, you know, GPs are, they're just kind of drug dealers and test takers. You kind of go there and they give you the tests you need and they give you the drugs you want. And that's kind of what they do.
Right. So maybe it won't be marijuana in 50 years. Who knows what it will be? Maybe it'll be naproxen. But
the oxycodone.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly didn't go to see a GP about my knee, though. I just went to a knee guy.
So on a similar vein, right, to computers and AI saving lives and things, right, we've got semi-autonomous cars, at least at the moment, saving lives. You've got something to say on that, Yadin?
Yeah, this was really to the story that happened out of Springfield, Missouri, where the driver had it in semi-autonomous driving mode, what's called autopilot, which doesn't actually drive the car where you want it to. You can't just set a destination and have it drive there, which I think is a good point. But what he had, he had a heart condition, so it was a pulmonary embolism.
Yeah.
Yes. And the hospital he found was actually right off the freeway. So what the car did was it took him 20 miles down the freeway, and he was able then to get off and just steer it into the parking lot of the hospital and get himself there. Now he said that, you know, he could have, of course, pulled over and called an ambulance, but he was convinced that he would have gotten there much, much faster, and there's a good chance that the car saved his life because he got there so much faster. Now, one thing I always like to make clear is that you have to actually touch the steering wheel every few minutes. You can't just keep your hands off the entire time. So when it's in autopilot, every few minutes you got to touch it, which he said he was able to do. What's that? If you don't, I think it comes out of autonomous driving mode, and you got to get your hands right on the wheel. So, but I don't know if it like veers you off the road or something, because that's a great question. I had that question too. Like, okay, if you don't touch it and it's blinking at you, does it just stop or something? Just stops.
Yeah. What if you pass out and your forehead's on the wheel and the car's honking and.
Yeah, see, I think nobody's coming out with those stories of, like, I got really wasted and I got in my Tesla car and somehow it got me home. Nobody's coming out with those stories.
Yet.
Shockingly.
Nobody would disclose that, yeah.
But it is another great example, right, isn't it, of where technology being put to good use to everyday, you know, things, saving lives, helping people, just makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I think this is a situation which I probably would have done what this guy Neely did, and I probably would have just said, "Look, I found a hospital nearby, and let me just get myself there as quick as possible. And if I can, you know, touch the steering wheel and kind of guide it to the hospital, you know, once I get close, then you know, I think that's the better solution." And I think that's something that just obviously would not have been possible. I mean, he could have gotten to a state where he couldn't have gotten himself to the hospital himself, and this car, you know, helped him do that. So, did the car save his life? Maybe, but eventually we're going to get to that point where, you know, cars will be able to, you know, do exactly that. They'll be able to take you where you need to go. You could be completely passed out, you know, with whatever condition that you might have, and the car will get you where you need to go.
What the hell? It'll be performing the surgery eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Laparoscopically.
He actually had to drive the last mile or so to the hospital once he got off the expressway, right? So, maybe the car saved his life, or maybe he could have caused like a major accident if he had not been in the right shape to finish it off. You know, I don't know what a pulmonary embolism feels like, but I can't imagine it's a nice feeling.
So apparently what it feels like is you have a rapid heart rate, lightness, short breath, rapid heart, can have chest pains.
I feel after drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Or feel like, you know, when you're going to talk to
I think after you take a couple lines of cocaine after you're drinking.
You know, you're going to go talk to John about something that's kind of important, you know, you know, and your heart starts beating quickly it's kind of those when you get over anxious. An embolism feels like that. It can include fainting. It can have more violent things like, you know, bloody coffee, spasmy things, which I think would be hard to drive while you're putting blood onto the windshield, but I don't think that's common. So it's, you know, I think it's a little bit of an overstatement to say that the car saved his life. It's not like he had an aneurysm, but you wouldn't know you were having an aneurysm anyway. They just break and then you die. So, it's a pretty cool story. I like the story. I think it's a little bit of an overstatement, though, to say it saved his life.
Yeah, and I would have to chime in on there with you, Mark, that that's why I kind of said that with hesitation. Like, it's kind of saved his life, maybe, but it's really kind of – the story is more talking to the fact that it's moving in that direction where the car will actually do that one day. But did it do it this time? Sort of.
I know this, though. I mean, it would be of great comfort, actually, to be able to have the car do that and to not worry about driving in the ditch or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's early days as well, isn't it? This is going to get way better. I mean, this is like the alpha version of the autonomous car, isn't it? So in the future, I've just seen a vision of the future while we're talking there. Not only will the car drive you there, but you'll have like a, I don't know, you'll have like a, an Apple Watch on or something that senses that you're having a pulmonary embolism, and it's going to then flash up a screen with a virtual doctor, and it's got a replicator in there, and it's going to, you know, mix you up some hash to calm you down while it takes you there. So, I mean, I would say of the four of us, right, this is, okay, it's a bit much to say it saved his life, but autonomous cars and things are a great thing for the future, right?
Yeah, I think it's headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark, I saw your Vulcan cast recently where you converted your Infiniti into a driverless car, and you liked that. How's that going?
Oh, it's great. I mean, everybody should have one. Yeah. We're all going to love driverless cars, I think, except for people that really want to drive stick shifts.
I'll tell you what, all this good stuff about automation and cars and things like that, we've had another issue where technology has let us down. And it's probably not the technology's fault per se here, but we had issues with Delta Airlines just, what is it? I don't know, a couple of weeks after we had issues with Southwest. So Delta grounded its fleet, is that right, for several hours earlier in the week?
Yeah, it ended up being about 10% of usual Monday daily traffic, I guess, however you want to play that, from about 2:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. I believe. 650
flights.
So what, Lauren?
10% was grounded, or 10% was in the air?
Grounded.
Oh, right.
As far as I know. Right. It ended up being about 650 flights that were affected.
Wow, that's a big thing.
Compared to Southwest, I think Southwest was in the thousands, so it's better than what Southwest went through. But what I can't understand, so they're saying the initial problem was a power outage in wherever they're based. Georgia, I think it was? I can't remember.
Atlanta.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the problem was that people were still checking in on their phones and on their computers, and the flights were saying that they're on time. And, you know, Delta's saying that some of their stuff didn't switch over to DR or whatever, that, you know, their alternate power source, what have you. So not only was it a power failure, which really shouldn't happen. I mean, you should always have redundant power, especially for a major company like Delta. But then why were people still able to check in, see that their flights were on time, even though they weren't? You know, what's going on in the back end there that didn't also get corrected? And I could understand if they were getting gibberish, if they were not able to log in, they were, you know, not able to check in. But it just seems a little odd to me, like it was both a power outage issue and a technology issue.
I wonder if there was a business decision made somewhere there. You know, because in these type of situations, and I've been in plenty of them myself, right, where you're in the middle of a P1 or whatever you want to call it, and the business are coming in saying, when's it going to be fixed? What's the update? And you're constantly feeding them updates. And they'll have like this emergency committee meeting, you know, for something big like this. And they'll be like humans making decisions saying, well, IT are telling us it's going to be back in like an hour. So let's not ground the fleet and let's not stop people checking in because, you know, and I wasn't involved in this, but I just wonder, you know, are we doing the right thing to blame the technology here? Were there business decisions made here to say, well, you know, fingers crossed here and cross your toes as well. We hope that it'll be back up and let's just let people keep logging in and maybe we ride this out with nobody even knowing.
But
and
I guess
that not working.
I guess my issue is more so that, I mean, people were checking in and people were seeing planes around time, but shouldn't there be some back end that says that it wasn't on time? I mean, I can't imagine someone's like, you know, doing some data entry on the back end. Like, they must know. So
maybe
what exactly
the back end is down?
Well, the back end, yeah, they said everything went down, basically. Their whole entire network, whether that's and not down, I guess, but was affected. So I just don't understand how the technology was even working, I guess. If parts of it weren't working, how was it reporting back misinformation?
I think that was the problem, is they didn't know. And so they decided to stop everything because they couldn't, you know, answer those questions.
And I don't see how a power outage causes all of that, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's something that seriously fell down here. Something of power outage at any point, there should be, you know, a DR strategy that that has been at least tested on some scale. And so whatever DR strategy that was tested, you know, obviously did not actually work, or there was a patch that was put in that, you know, that rendered it useless, and they tried to bring everything back up again and just didn't come back up.
Yeah, I think they're very big, you know, complex networks of systems. And, you know, it may be that the dependencies on information from one group of systems to another aren't that well understood, right? So some systems went down, obviously some were still up. If you could check into a flight, there was a way to check in. You know, you don't know where the check-in happens, why those systems don't get updated. And, you know, are they using in some cases third party gear to do some of this, or are they using outside services for some of it? You know, it's fascinating to think about. Right. How could you check into a flight that everybody knows is canceled? You know, that's weird.
Yeah. So, yeah, what I'm surprised more is that this stuff actually works as well as it does. Because and Lauren, you and I talked about this on one of the podcasts that we did together. It's doing this. This is hard. And testing, once you've got this something like a DR strategy architected and planned out, testing that
impossible.
Is really hard. And you can't actually testing. Yeah, it's because you can't actually test what's actually going in production right now, because you'd have to create an entirely other, you know, entirely new environment that actually mirrored 100% your production environment, and then bring all the power down and then see what happens. You know, a cascade, you know, effect of a worldwide, you know, mirrored environment. You just can't do that. It's not financially feasible. It's not physically feasible. You have to do the best you can to plan for an event like this. And if it works, it does. If it doesn't, obviously in Delta's case, it didn't.
Yeah. You know, you wonder about the battery backup for this. What happened to power backup, right? There's, there are contingency plans. What do you want to say something, Lauren?
Yeah, so I guess the issue was a failed switchgear, which is basically like a fuse box at your house, and not all of the systems went over to the redundant switchgear, I guess, or, you know, whether they had a redundant one, I guess, you know, they could tell us pretty much anything they wanted to, but that just seems ridiculous to me.
That's not uncommon, where, you know, a company that has a diesel generator for electric power in case of emergency, the diesel generators don't start. Mm-hmm. That's happened several times, whether it's because they're out of gas, the gas is bad, or some other malfunction in the diesel generator. So something like a switch box, you know, an electrical switch box, oversized circuit breaker, if you will. Whoa, you don't have extras of those lying around.
But they also said that some systems did fail over. So it was more of a technology issue. I mean, granted, this is all from the Wall Street Journal article, and we can post that. I just think there's more to the story.
So should this stuff be done in the cloud? Would Delta have been better off if somehow they'd been able to have all of this stuff running in the cloud, which, you know, would probably take 40 years to port it all there? But does the cloud solve this problem?
$8 million. Although, and would they say, I mean, they lost millions of dollars on Monday, right? I mean,
yeah.
That might be worth it. I don't know.
I would say, right, can I say that the cloud would probably solve that particular problem, but it brings a whole host of other complexities. You know, you'd be like, I don't know, switching out. What, because we're saying here, right, that these systems are massively complex, right? They're beasts, yeah? You'd be switching out one beast for another at the end of the day. There's no way that, you know, you're going to take something as legacy, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense here, right? Delta are a long-standing company. A lot of their technology and their applications and back-ends and physical infrastructure is going to be old. You know, you don't take that and turn it into something that you could run on your laptop, but you are running in the cloud. It's like dead simple, do you? It's just, I mean, all of the cloud providers have their issues, have their outages, and it's not uncommon for them to have outages, yet the status page say that everything's hunky-dory, right? So I don't think it would fix it.
But what if it was running in Docker?
Well, if you say that.
How do you move a mainframe
everything's better when
application
it runs in
Docker containers?
That is a very good question. You don't. Yeah.
Oh, you know, one thing we should put in the show notes too is this great video, an awkward conversation about microservices. Have you seen that? It's where this one scene from a movie about Hitler
Oh, yes.
is it has subtitles, you know, talking about how great isolation was and we could scale it all out, and Hitler's jumping up and down saying isolation, all these containers and microservices are causing more problems. You got to put that in the show
notes. I've seen that, so I can
awkward conversation about microservices.
Yeah. Hey, so can we pivot here, right? So we're talking here about, you know, an issue with a failed component, let's just say, right, brings down Delta Airlines for a while, or, you know, brings down part of its fleet, causes a lot of havoc. There's another side of things as we come a lot more involved with technology, or technology kind of becomes more pervasive, and that's the hacking side of things, right? Because there have been a few stories recently, so apparently there's maybe up to 1 billion Android smartphones, and usually the top-end ones on the new Qualcomm Snapdragon processors, potentially at risk for being exploited. And then there was a story about another Internet of Things device, a thermostat, a home thermostat, can be hacked. So not only are we, you know, everything that we do relies on technology, and when things break, we're in trouble and people lose millions of dollars, but also it's not just things breaking, is it? Things are getting hacked all the time, and we're more and more reliant on these things.
Yeah, I agree. Nigel, it's a quad router, I guess, is the name of the virus or whatever malware that is affecting these Android devices. And it's actually from Qualcomm. It's in the chip, which is the problem. You know, Android's got, not only do you have Qualcomm and Google coming together to put out patches, but then it's got to go through each carrier. And, you know, it's a lot of different moving parts, so it's hard to get things patched. With the thermostats, I mean, that is an interesting play as well. They're showing how easy it is to hack these thermostats. And I actually read an article about hacking front door smart locks, right? Because the smart locks are just doing plain text. When you use your phone to put in the password, it's just doing plain text. So anyone who's like war driving, doing some sort of Bluetooth sniffing, can basically get the key to your house by parking nearby and having a pretty strong Bluetooth sniffer. I mean, it's 2016.
And they're passing passwords in plain text. It's just...
And not all of them, but yeah.
No, I get that. But it's no big secret, is it, that the Internet of Things is full of vulnerabilities and security holes and things like that. All of these devices out there, it's almost like, and I'm sure this probably is the case actually, that the manufacturers of these devices are just focusing on features, and not taking nearly seriously enough the security aspects of things. I mean, who wants a connected home that's got all the features in the world, but can be, you know, pwned by somebody without, you know, a great deal of effort? Because, look, let's be honest, a lot of effort has gone into securing technology within the perimeters of a company's own infrastructure, behind its own firewalls, things like that. A lot of security has gone into cloud service providers like Azure and Amazon Web Services and all of those things. But it's almost a laughingstock, the whole Internet of Things at the moment. I know it's early days, right, and this has not been deployed en masse, but, you know, you can't read anything on technology on the Internet these days without stumbling across articles that are saying, you know, these things are wide freaking open.
Oh, they are. They are absolutely wide open. And that's the dominant opinion. And everyone recognizes that and realizes that. But two, I think you brought up one key point in that, is that people don't care enough yet to not adopt these unless they pass them, you know, some level of security. You're going to get people who are going to buy these products based on feature sets and feel that, you know what, they're secure enough. But someone who's buying this for their front door lock, I don't see how you can do that in good conscience, understanding that the password passing between device and your door is not 100% secure. And anyone, you know, can post something online, you know, at some black hat forum saying, hey, this is how you unlock this model of door. And somebody walks around, detects that model of doors there and just walks into your home. I mean, that's going to what you're going to see, and you're going to see the pendulum swing the other way. But everything from the Internet of Things to all of the, you know, the trusted systems that we depend on today all had flaws at the beginning. I mean, the reason the Internet was even created is because the modern phone system at that time had these intense hub vulnerabilities that the government wanted to circumvent in the case of, you know, a catastrophic attack. And this, the Internet of Things is going to be the same way, where you're going to have a whole bunch of vulnerabilities, And there is going to be eventually things put in place that will allow you to actually secure them to, you know, at least to like the 90th, you know, 95th percentile. But there's always going to be exploits, no matter what system.
So does anybody know how these door locks compare to automotive locks on cars?
No, I don't. So, and when you ask that, Mark, are you taught what is an automotive lock? Because I have this thing, right? So my car is one of those where you don't have to put the key in. The key's just got to be inside of the car and you hit the start button, right?
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, well, why would I care about carrying a key around? I carry my phone with me everywhere. Why can't I just have my phone unlock and start my car? Is that already out there? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, we've got a number of things that we're already using, you know, remote locks for. Why are home smart locks any more susceptible to attack than an automobile lock?
I think they're probably not.
Because it's different technology. You'll have like RF, you know, encryption, or a key, you know, exchange with, let's say, like, you know, a door lock. But with like something like a Wi-Fi, something that's got to, you know, connect to the Wi-Fi in your home and then send a signal to the door, you know, either that's on the same Wi-Fi network or you've got a Bluetooth connection between the two. That's sort of a different.
Oh my God. That is the last thing I want. The last thing I want is my house key to be operated by my goddamn phone.
Yeah. That's just a gaping hole.
Freaking believable.
I do want that.
I've got one.
I do not want that.
So we got two hots and two nots for that. It won't be long, Mark, before you can't buy a house without a lock like that.
I can't get in my house because my phone doesn't have a charge.
No, but when you roll up stoned, drunk, and you can't find the lock with the key, and you're just tapping on the, where's the keyhole?
You just carry it in your pocket like your car.
That's right.
I think that's a more prevalent British problem.
Oh, is that right?
That product will take off there. But I think this is going to be one of those things where it's like there's that curmudgeon in front of you in the grocery store that's trying to write a check for their groceries, you know, and I'm going to be that curmudgeon. I think like when I'm like, you know what, I'm going to be like the kid behind me is going to be just to do the retinal scan. Just do the retinal scan. No, I'm going to pull out my phone and use Apple Pay like I did when I – back in the day. I'm using Apple Pay. Retinal scan.
Hey, we've not got this on the agenda, but did you guys see the story about the police working with a scientist to take a 3D print of a dead guy's thumb and apply an electrical coating to it to unlock his phone?
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. How cool was that? No?
Okay, my first question was, why didn't they just cut the guy's thumb off?
I know. That? No, but it needed to have like an electrical impulse or something, because apparently to unlock these fingerprinted phones, you can't just take like, there's got to be some form of, I don't know, yeah, what I just said there.
Put a couple wires to his finger and then press the phone on there. What's, I'm sorry, this isn't rocket science.
Hot wire, hot wire his finger.
When you're dead.
Hot wire.
Exactly.
Hey guys, this is great, but we're running a bit long. We've not touched any business news yet.
Ah, who cares about business?
Business.
Business makes the world go round, though, doesn't it? So,
well, I keep telling everyone when I roll into the office, this job would be so much easier if it wasn't for all these clients.
There you go.
Oh, no. How much fun could we have with technology if there was no business to satisfy?
Exactly.
Aren't you, like, trying to become the chief client officer or something there? I mean, you need... Oh.
Yeah. My title is actually Principal Engagement Manager, which is pretty much Chief Client Officer.
I think you nailed it there.
I'm going to use that one. I'm taking
you
that
are
one,
a
Mark.
PEM?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Let's roll it onto the business news then. So, got a few stories here, right? Rackspace, they've had the for sale sign up for ages. They might eventually be being bought, according to stories. But at the same time, they've flogged one of their own internal business units. So maybe we'll talk about that. We've got Google are acquiring, trying to gun down Amazon Web Services. They acquired Orbitera. I think that's how you pronounce it. Looks like BlackBerry are in the long tail of death there. They're resorting to suing companies these days for cash. And an interesting one, I think, VM Turbo are changing its name, but they've also been told they can't present at VMworld in a couple of weeks. So that's what we've got in the business news. Go on, who fancies any of them?
I fancy the VM Turbo story.
Have the VM Turbo one then. Go on.
The VM Turbo story was really interesting. So they're changing their name to Turbonomic, apparently. Oh, to boy. Get away from, ooh. Yeah, yeah.
It's not really an improvement.
No, they've filed two patents, one for, you know, having downloadable software, one for doing a SaaS type of solution for Turbonomic under that name. And apparently they don't want it to be VM something because it's too close to VMware. Even though they still deal with virtual machines and all of that, they're actually trying to go more into other hypervisors now. But apparently... The real problem is that their product comes way too close to what used to be called vCenter Operations, which is now vRealize Operations. I wrote a book about it. Don't worry.
Shameless plug.
But the problem is VMware doesn't like that competition, right? Basically, I think that's what it boils down to. So now they're telling VM Turbo to cancel their sessions and any speaking engagements they had at VMworld scheduled coming up in a couple weeks here. So VM Turbo nor VMware were available for comment according to the article I read.
Of course not.
Right. But it's not a new thing. I don't think it's uncommon. This has happened before, right?
Sure. But this is right. At the end of the day, this is a ringing endorsement, surely, from VMware for VM Turbo or Turbonomics, whatever they're called by the time I get around to editing the podcast, who knows. But this is a ringing endorsement, right? Anytime you do something like this, you're basically saying you're scared.
Yeah, well, they're hitting down. And, you know, from what I've always heard is if you're a large company, you don't hit down. It just makes you look bad.
You don't hit down? I don't know what that means. What do you
meaning
mean?
Meaning VM Turbo's not...
You don't understand that?
No.
VM Turbo's not a large mammoth company. You know, it's not a startup. I mean, it's 2009, I think, is when they first... came around, and which is probably around the time vCenter Operations actually got going, maybe a little after that. But
did vCenter Operations ever get going? Sorry.
My book didn't tell you that much. But yeah, they're basically hitting down. They're boxing underweight, I guess. Or overweight.
So bullying,
however.
Yeah. In a way. Okay. Hey, does anybody think their name change to Turbonomics is hot?
Oh, no. Oh, very, very much not.
Nope.
So, according to the wisdom of Intequi Trust, don't change your name, guys. Come on.
Do you think we should change the name of our podcast to VM Turbo now that it's available?
Definitely.
VM Turbo we trust.
What about VM Turbonomics? Oh.
In Turbonomics we trust. There you go.
Yeah.
It just doesn't even like say what the company does. Not that it has to, but
it
like,
sounds like a toy that you get, you know, at the Toys R Us or something, you know?
Right.
I'm gonna give my kid the Turbonomics for Christmas.
Or some sort of like SSD type of integrate, you know, it just I don't understand it. But you know,
no, right. For me, it reminds me of that hideous keyboard I got one year from Microsoft that was like cracked in half down the middle and on an angle, you know, like an upside down V, and it was supposed to be ergonomically better to type on. I think ergonomics. Anybody remember that keyboard? You must.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a friend who had one of those that just absolutely thought it was the beast.
Was that the famous wrist crevasse keyboard?
I tried to type on it.
The wrist crevasse. That's our new name.
Yes.
The wrist crevassers.
That's the name of the podcast right there.
This crevassier. Week.
Wrist crevassier.
Do we want to talk about anything else or just do hot or not? I don't care. I'm on holiday.
Yeah. Well, we hit the thing. We talked last week a little bit about the uselessness of patents. And now we find out that patents are quite useful to put your company on life support, just trolling anybody and everybody can.
This is just a sad story. This is just a very, very sad story.
The CEO of BlackBerry is just happy to troll the rest of his life away.
This would be like if, you know, if Al Gore decided because he lost the presidential, you know, race to now sue a bunch of companies you know, based on some patents for inventing the internet. That's kind of what I equate this to. And yes, BlackBerry actually was awarded these patents that date back to 1998. But I'm sorry, guys. They're citing that BlackBerry revolutionized the mobile industry, and I'm using air quotes right now for those of you who can't see me. And it had, you know, invented a broad array of new technologies that cover everything from enhanced security and cryptographic techniques to blah blah blah. It's like, I'm sorry, you can't now sue everyone because you basically invented or revolutionized the mobile industry. That's not a real business model. But unfortunately, they've got a case within our legal system, which is, as you pointed out, Mark, and I pointed out last week, is broken from a patent perspective, and they're going to go ahead and this rat hole to put themselves on life support till, you know, they die a long, slow death.
Now, they're not hitting down as in Avaya or some like baby company.
No, they're punching up.
No, no, I appreciate that. But I'm thinking it's similar to VMware, you know, you're going through turbulent water at the moment. Okay, VMware, not so much as BlackBerry, right? But again, VMware is struggling compared to how they've, you know, been racing ahead in the past. This kind of thing is just, this is what you do. It's like holding your hands up and saying, we're not having a great time anymore. So we have to start picking on other people, isn't it?
That's calling the lawyers. How long will it be till we have artificial intelligence systems going through a company's patent portfolio to find the potential lawsuits? I mean, that's what's going to happen. And we'll just have lawsuits in cyberspace. We'll just have courts in the cloud.
Well, that's one thing I would endorse, that AI replacing lawyers. I think that might be a good thing.
Oh, I get what you say. I do get what you're saying there, right? But honestly, of all the things that AI and big data analytics and things can be used for, you know, we've talked about cures for cancer. We've talked about, you know, diagnosis of diseases and illnesses and things. You know, this would be just to go and trawl through patents and raise lawsuits and things. Oh, no.
Nigel, it's just a matter of time and you know it.
Oh, I do know it. I know it. And that's the sad thing. But you know what? It might be faster than the existing legal system. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe we could have Watson be judge and jury. We have 12 Watsons in a room.
Yeah.
Might make a good reality TV show.
Oh, God. To close the circle here, the BlackBerry privs were also hit by that quadruder virus, too. So the one
or two of them.
Supposed to be. Yeah. Right. They're supposed to be so secure and all that, but not so much.
Maybe Turbonomics can help.
I'm sure they can. So what was our hot or not? Come on, let's just wind out. Lauren, you can lead us out with a hot or not, can't you?
Sure. So Google and a company called Dashlane, I believe, are working on a project called YOLO, standing for You Only Log In Once. So basically it's a way to use kind of a password manager on your Android phones. It will automatically, once you enter, you know, your passwords into this password manager, it will automatically, the APIs will be set up such that once you've already done that, you don't have to keep logging into everything. So my question for you guys, is this a hot or not project?
Hot, 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 hot.
Dreadfully cold.
I knew the curmudgeon would
Mark,
say that.
The contrarian. I'm going to go with hot. Right here, okay? Just because Mark said not hot, and I'm going to make up a reason.
I think we're 2-2. We're 2-2, then. We've got a tie, you guys. Our first ever, I think.
Gabriel, where's Gabriel?
Yeah, to break the tie. You know what? You know, I created this little summy card that was for Okta, and I said, you know, the funnest. It was a picture of like a dad and his kid next to a computer, and it said the funnest thing about logging into Okta is it gets more fun every time you do it. And I sent it out as a tweet, and Okta actually retweeted it. Which I thought was fantastic.
Famous.
And this is why I think I'd like this, because if I could just log in one time and it could maintain trust in a secure way without just opening me up to a massive vulnerability, then yes, please give me that.
A massive vulnerability, like you losing your phone?
Like somebody having the phone taken out of your hand, right?
Yeah,
in
and if they then 3D map my thumb and apply electrical impulse to it and unlock my phone and then get, you know, into all my passwords, then yeah, you know,
chop your thumb off too, you know. There you go.
There you go.
I don't think your assets are worth all that hassle. Maybe I'm wrong.
Lauren's, I don't think there's a monetization.
Lauren's
right. Yeah. Man, get some of that VC money.
I wish.
Yeah, the investment queen there. Can I tell you why I think this is hot, right? I've just opened the file that I have on my PC, right, that I keep all my passwords in.
Oh, no, you don't.
I'm not lying here. Okay, well, I don't put the passwords out in full. I kind of have my own cryptographics.
You have a cipher. Okay? You have a password cipher.
My own cipher, yeah.
You check spell this out right. All the letters.
yes. No, let me ask you, how many lines, I'm going to ask each of you in turn, how many lines do you think I have in my passwords file on my PC? Yadin, how many lines do you
48.
Think? 48. Mark?
3.
Lauren?
I was going to say 1.
158 lines.
Oh, see, if we were on The Price is Right, I would have won that right there.
Yeah, but is it like a matrix with diagonals and all that stuff? Is it a puzzle?
It's not, no. No, it does have, so I was going to say as well, 158 lines, 5,913 characters. But they're not just all passwords, right? There are usernames ciphered in there. And there are also, like, you know, the name of the website or the name of the technology or whatever in there as well. So it's not, you know, that's not all just passwords. But everything that I've got to log into effectively has its own line, 158 lines. That right there makes that technology.
But don't you have passwords that are things like, you know, 48 robins pooped on my second garage?
How did that? That is actually one of my passwords. No, no, I don't.
Diggory Pokery 429.
That's what they all are.
F Jiggery and Pokery.
Yeah.
Even variations.
Great. Now I've got to go change all my passwords.
You need Dashlane.
Nah, yes, I do.
Dashlane to manage your passwords. You really do.
It's super hot. It's smoking hot. I'm in Cancun Resort in Vegas right now, and it's 106 outside. Ooh. And that is cold compared to this technology.
Smoking
come
hot.
Come on then, Mark. Come on,
smoking.
We want the rebuttal.
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah. I don't mind having to retrieve passwords every now and then for things that I want to keep secure. You know, passwords that are in my head that just, they're there. I'm just one of those guys. Right. And, you know, whether they're bank accounts or that kind of thing, it's just like, nope. I don't store any of those things on my machine. I don't keep them in files. I don't do that. I forget passwords and then have to regenerate new ones. And I'm happy to do that.
Yadin?
I'm sorry, was I supposed to render opinion on that?
I didn't know if you, I mean, you said an opinion.
You could
but
call
I didn't
me a curmudgeon yet again for the fourth time. But no one's standing behind me while I'm doing this, right? It's not like I'm
I do. I do password ciphering. So I have like 3-character ciphers that remind me of what, you know, the password is. And it's just totally cryptic of, it has nothing to do with, you know, the letters in the cipher have nothing to do with the actual letters that were in the password. They remind me, oh, you know, that 3-letter cipher. Okay. That's what that password is. And I can generate the password based on the cipher. So I think I find that incredibly useful so that it can store the ciphers, you know, in plain text and not have to worry about anything.
They should teach that in elementary school these days, actually. Everybody should know that trick or that
but
skill.
That's what I do, and I've got 158 lines of it, so that's why this YOLO idea is much better. Yeah,
YOLO.
For those who can't see Yadin, he is nodding his head. No,
couldn't you just use a password manager though? I don't understand. I mean, not on your phone necessarily. Well, I'm sure you could, but I don't understand.
No, they've got too many vulnerabilities.
Oh, I see. But you're still using a password manager in this YOLO situation. It's just the API that allows you to automatically log it in.
Oh, so I'm saying something's hot when I really haven't got a clue about what it is.
So
you probably got most of your passwords stored in Google Chrome. Oh, anyway, yeah. So it doesn't matter.
So when I had my phone stolen in London back in last September, you know, almost a year ago, you know, it gave me some amount of solace to understand that they would have to enter a code to get into the phone. But then what was interesting is I went to try to change passwords for, I don't even know why I did this. It's just my paranoia, right? I went to change passwords for a couple accounts that I logged into, just because I was concerned that those, for one reason or another, those that might still be valid. Access to those accounts might still be valid. And, what was interesting is I found out while in London, I couldn't access my account with Verizon to turn off the phone, right? And that's because I think I talked about this before. It had 2-factor authentication. And so when I got onto the website and so I could access my account, and then it wanted to send me the code to my phone so I could access the account online. Of course, it didn't work because I didn't have my phone. So this searching for a password or regenerating a new password has its problems too.
Did you have an iPhone? Or you had an Android?
I have one of those Androids that anybody can break into, apparently.
Yeah, oh. I heard about that.
So here's my final analysis too. I think it's fine. I don't, you know, I think it's a fine idea. I don't think it's hot or cold necessarily. What I think is hotter is to put a fingerprint scanner on the back of every phone. I log into my phone. I log into my bank, all of that with a fingerprint. And yeah, they can cut off my fingers, but at that point, I probably don't care if like they're already cutting limbs and whatnot.
If somebody wants your big stash of VC money that bad, Lauren, there.
They're going to find a way to get it.
What do you think I'm in the States for at the moment? I'm hunting you down. I'm going to chop
you. Oh, see, that's why you're in Vegas. You're doing an Ocean's 11 style heist. Yeah.
You're just saying you're in Vegas. You're actually in Indiana.
Yeah, I'm watching you right now.
Across the street.
There is an empty apartment building across the street. I'm picturing Nigel
right now.
Camped out.
It's that mysterious Verizon van that's been parked across your street for 2 weeks.